owing to the randomness of his profession. I do not need to test it. The Russian roulette thought experiment suffices. All I need is to show that there exists an alternative explanation to the theory that he is a genius. My approach is to manufacture a cohort of intellectually challenged persons and show how a small minority can evolve into successful businessmen. But these are the ones who will be visible. I am not saying that Warren Buffett is not skilled, only that a large population of random investors will almost necessarily produce someone with his track records just by luck. Missing a hoax. I was also surprised at the fact that in spite of the book's aggressive warning against media journalism, I was invited to television and radio shows in both North America and Europe, including a hilarious dialogue du jour on a Las Vegas radio station where the interviewer and I were running two parallel conversations. Nobody protected me from myself, and I accepted the interviews. Strangely, one needs to use the press to communicate the message that the press is toxic. I felt like a fraud coming up with vapid sound bites, but had fun at it. It may be that I was invited because the mainstream media interviewers did not read my book or understand the insults. They don't have the time to read books. And the nonprofit ones read it too well and felt vindicated by it. I have a few anecdotes. A famous television show was told that this guy Taleb believes that stock analysts are just random forecasters. So they seemed eager to have me present my ideas on the program. However, their condition was that I make 3 stock recommendations to prove my expertise. I didn't attend, and missed the opportunity for a great hoax by discussing 3 stocks selected randomly and fitting a well-sounded explanation to my selection. On another television show, I mentioned that people think that there is a story when there is none, as I was discussing the random character of the stock market and the backfit logic one always sees in events after the fact. The anchor immediately interjected, "There was a story about Cisco this morning. Can you comment on that?" The best? When invited to an hour-long discussion on a financial radio show, they had not read Chapter 11, I was told a few minutes before to refrain from discussing the ideas in this book because I was invited to talk about trading and not about randomness. Another hoax opportunity, certainly, but I was too unprepared for it and walked out before the show started. Most journalists do not take things too seriously. After all, this business of journalism is about pure entertainment, not a search for truth, particularly when it comes to radio and television. The trick is to stay away from those who do not seem to know that they are just entertainers, like George Will, who will appear in Chapter 2, and actually believe that they are thinkers. Another problem was in the interpretation of the message in the media. This guy Nassim thinks the markets are random, hence they are going lower, which made me the unwilling bearer of catastrophic messages. Black swans, those rare and unexpected deviations, can be both good and bad events. However, media journalism is less standardized than it appears. It attracts a significant segment of thoughtful people who manage to extricate themselves from the commercial soundbite-driven system and truly care about the message, rather than just catching the public's attention. One naive observation from my conversations with Kojo Namdi, NPR, Robin Lustig, BBC, Robert Scully, PBS, and Brian Lehrer, WNYC, is that the non-profit journalist is altogether another intellectual breed. Casually, the quality of the discussion correlates inversely with the luxury of the studios. WNYC, where I felt that Brian Lehrer was making the greatest effort at getting into the arguments, operates out of the shabbiest offices I have seen this side of Kazakhstan. One final comment on the style. I elected to keep the style of this book as idiosyncratic as it was in the first edition. Homo sum, good and bad. I am fallible and see no reason to hide my minor flaws if they are part of my personality, no more than I feel the need to wear a wig when I have my picture taken or borrow someone else's nose when I show my face. Almost all the book editors who read the draft recommended changes at the sentence level to make my style better, and in the structure of the text, in the organization of chapters. I ignored almost all of them, and found out that none of the readers thought them necessary. As a matter of fact, I find that injecting the personality of the author, imperfections included, enlivens the text. Does the book industry suffer from the classical expert problem with the buildup of rules of thumb that do not have empirical validity? More than 100,000 readers later, I am discovering that books are not written for book editors. Prologue. Mosques in the Clouds. This book is about luck, disguised and perceived as non-luck, that is, skills, and more generally, randomness disguised and perceived as non-randomness, that is, determinism. It manifests itself in the shape of the lucky fool, defined as a person who benefited from a disproportionate share of luck, but attributes his success to some other, generally very precise, reason. Such confusion crops up in the most unexpected areas, even science, though not in such an accentuated and obvious manner as it does in the world of business. It is endemic in politics, as it can be encountered in the shape of a country's president, discoursing on the jobs that he created, his recovery, and his predecessor's inflation. We are still very close to our ancestors who roamed the savannah. The formation of our beliefs is fraught with superstitions, even today, I might say especially today. Just as one day some primitive tribesman scratched his nose, saw rain falling, and developed an elaborate method of scratching his nose to bring on the much-needed rain, we link economic prosperity to some rate cut by the Federal Reserve Board, or the success of a company with the appointment of the new president at the helm. Bookstores are full of biographies of successful men and women, presenting their specific explanation on how they made it big in life. We have an expression, the right time at the right place, to weaken whatever conclusion can be inferred from them. This confusion strikes people of different persuasions. The literature professor invests a deep meaning into a mere coincidental occurrence of word patterns, while the economist proudly detects regularities and anomalies in data that are plain random. At the cost of appearing biased, I have to say that the literary mind can be intentionally prone to the confusion between noise and meaning, that is, between a randomly constructed arrangement and a precisely intended message. However, this causes little harm. Few claim that art is a tool of investigation of the truth, rather than an attempt to escape it or make it more palatable. Symbolism is the child of our inability and unwillingness to accept randomness. We give meaning to all manner of shapes. We detect human figures in ink blots. "I saw mosques in the clouds," announced Arthur Rimbaud, the 19th-century French symbolic poet. This interpretation took him to poetic Abyssinia in East Africa, where he was brutalized by a Christian Lebanese slave dealer, contracted syphilis, and lost a leg to gangrene. He gave up poetry in disgust at the age of 19 and died, anonymously, in a Marseille hospital ward while still in his 30s. But it was too late. European intellectual life developed what seemed to be an irreversible taste for symbolism. We are still paying its price, with psychoanalysis and other fads. Regrettably, some people play the game too seriously. They are paid to read too much into things. All my life I have suffered the conflict between my love of literature and poetry and my profound allergy to most teachers of literature and critics. The French thinker and poet Paul Valéry was surprised to listen to a commentary of his poems that found meanings that had until then escaped him. Of course, it was pointed out to him that these were intended by his subconscious. More generally, we underestimate the share of randomness in about everything, a point that may not merit a book, except when it is the specialist who was the fool of all fools. Disturbingly, science has only recently been able to handle randomness. The growth in available information has been exceeded only by the expansion of noise. Probability theory is a young arrival in mathematics. Probability applied to practice is almost non-existent as a discipline. In addition, we seem to have evidence that what is called courage comes from an underestimation of the share of randomness in things, rather than the more noble ability to stick one's neck out for a given belief. In my experience, and in the scientific literature, economic risk-takers are rather the victims of delusions, leading to over-optimism and overconfidence with their underestimation of possible adverse outcomes, than the opposite. Their risk-taking is frequently randomness foolishness. Consider the left and right columns of the Table of Confusion, which I will read in just a moment. The best way to summarize the major thesis of this book is that it addresses situations, many of them tragicomical, where the first item in the left column is mistaken for the one in the right. The subsections also illustrate the key areas of discussion on which this book will be based. The reader may wonder whether the opposite case might not deserve some attention, that is, the situations where non-randomness is mistaken for randomness. Shouldn't we be concerned with situations where patterns and messages may have been ignored? I have two answers. First, I am not overly worried about the existence of undetected patterns. We have been reading lengthy and complex messages and just about any manifestation of nature that presents jaggedness, such as the palm of a hand, the residues at the bottom of Turkish coffee cups, etc. Armed with home supercomputers and chained processors, and helped by complexity and chaos theories, the scientists, semi-scientists, and pseudo-scientists will be able to find portents. Second, we need to take into account the costs of mistakes. In my opinion, mistaking the items in the right-hand column from the ones in the left is not as costly an error in the opposite direction. Even popular opinion warns that bad information is worse than no information at all. So here is the Table of Confusion, presenting the central distinctions used in this book. Under the general category, luck versus skills, randomness versus determinism, probability versus certainty, belief and conjecture versus knowledge and certitude, theory versus reality, anecdote and coincidence versus causality and law, and forecast versus prophecy. Under the market performance category, lucky idiot versus skilled investor, and survivorship bias versus market outperformance. In the finance category, we have volatility versus return or drift, and stochastic variable versus deterministic variable. In the physics and engineering category, noise versus signal. In the literary criticism category, we have none. Literary critics do not seem to have a name for things they do not understand. Versus symbol. In the philosophy of science category, epistemic probability versus physical probability, induction versus deduction, and synthetic proposition versus analytic proposition. And finally, in the general philosophy category, we have contingent versus certain, contingent versus necessary in the Kripke sense, and finally, contingent versus true in all possible worlds. However interesting these areas could be, their discussion would be a tall order. There is one world in which I believe the habit of mistaking luck for skill is most prevalent and most conspicuous, and that is the world of markets. By luck or misfortune, that is the world in which I have operated most of my adult life. It is what I know best. In addition, economic life presents the best, and most entertaining, laboratory for the understanding of these differences. For it is in the area of human undertaking where the confusion is greatest and its effects the most pernicious. For instance, we often have the mistaken impression that a strategy is an excellent strategy, or an entrepreneur a person endowed with vision, or a trader a talented trader, only to realize that 99.9% of their past performance is attributable to chance, and chance alone. Ask a profitable investor to explain the reasons for his success. He will offer some deep and convincing interpretation of the results. Frequently, these delusions are intentional and deserve to bear the name charlatanism. If there is one cause for this confusion between the left and the right sides of our table of confusion, it is our inability to think critically. We may enjoy presenting conjectures as truth. It is our nature. Our mind is not equipped with the adequate machinery to handle probabilities. Such infirmity even strikes the expert, sometimes just the expert. The 19th-century cartoon character, pot-bellied bourgeois Monsieur Prudhomme, carried around a large sword with a double intent, primarily to defend the Republic against its enemies, and secondarily to attack it should it stray from its course. In the same manner, this book has two purposes: to defend science as a light beam across the noise of randomness, and to attack the scientist when he strays from his course. Most disasters come from the fact that individual scientists do not have an innate understanding of standard error or a clue about critical thinking, and likewise have proved both incapable of dealing with probabilities in the social sciences and incapable of accepting such fact. As a practitioner of uncertainty, I have seen more than my share of snake oil salesmen dressed in the garb of scientists, particularly those operating in economics. The greatest fools of randomness will be found among these. We are flawed beyond repair, at least for this environment. But it is only bad news for those utopians who believe in an idealized humankind. Current thinking presents the two following polarized visions of man, with little shades in between. On the one hand, there is your local college English professor, your great aunt Irma, who never married and liberally delivers sermons, your How to Reach Happiness in 20 Steps and How to Become a Better Person in a Week book writer. It is called the utopian vision, associated with Rousseau, Godwin, Caritas, Thomas Paine, and conventional normative economists, of the kind to ask you to make rational choices because that is what is deemed good for you, etc. They believe in reason and rationality, that we should overcome cultural impediments on our way to becoming a better human race, thinking we can control our nature at will and transform it by mere edict in order to attain, among other things, happiness and rationality. Basically, this category would include those who think that the cure for obesity is to inform people that they should be healthy. On the other hand, there is the tragic vision of humankind that believes in the existence of inherent limitations and flaws in the way we think and act, and requires an acknowledgement of this fact as a basis for any individual and collective action. This category of people includes Karl Popper, falsificationism and distrust of intellectual answers, actually of anyone who is confident that he knows anything with certainty, Friedrich Hayek and Milton Friedman, suspicion of governments, Adam Smith, intention of man, Herbert Simon, bounded rationality, Amos Tversky and Daniel Kahneman, heuristics and biases, the speculator George Soros, etc. The most neglected one is the misunderstood philosopher Charles Sanders Peirce, who was born 100 years too early. He coined the term scientific fallibilism in opposition to papal infallibility. Needless to say that the ideas of this book fall squarely into the tragic category. We are faulty, and there is no need to bother trying to correct our flaws. We are so defective and so mismatched to our environment that we can just work around these flaws. I am convinced that after spending almost all my adult and professional years in a fierce fight between my brain, not fooled by randomness, and my